I prefer to call it payment for services rendered. A simple business transaction. You Ballingers understand that, don't you? Jace's voice turned flat and to the point.
What do you want?
Reparations, I answered. I want everything that was stolen from the Venden settlement restored, with interest, and all their destroyed structures, pens, and fences rebuilt. Tempers exploded. A host of angry objections whirled between them. Jace jumped to his feet.
Are you out of your mind? Haven't you gotten the message? We want them to leave. It is their right to be there. Venda has gone to great expense and effort in establishing this settlement, and the King of Ilandia specifically approved the site.
Jace growled.
The king who doesn't know hell's mouth from his own ass?
I shrugged. No reparations. No letter.
No!
Jace went off on a rant, walking around the room, his hands waving, punching the air, reiterating that his family hadn't destroyed anything, and helping the Vendens would be the same as posting a welcome sign for anyone to come and take what they wanted. All of his objections were punctuated and reinforced by the others. They fed off each other like a pack of jackals.
They are half the cause of our troubles in the first place. You let one encroach on your territory, and then everyone thinks you're weak, and they want a piece too.
I sighed. They are 7 families. 25 people. It's not even land that you use. Are the Ballingers so very small that a few families are a big threat? Can you not see them as an asset instead? A way to grow your dynasty? They looked at me like I was speaking a foreign language. I leaned back, crossing my arms. Those are my terms. Angry glances bounced between them, but no words. I watched their frustration mount, jaws growing rigid, nostrils flaring, chests rising with furious indignation. The silence ticked.
We'll move them, Jace finally said, and rebuild in another location.
A heated chorus of grunts erupted. The others objected to this concession. But it has to be fair and equitable, I answered. Water, good land, and still within a day's ride of Hell's Mouth.
It will be.
I have one other stipulation.
Gunner's hands flew into the air. Can I wring her neck right now?
The Ballingers must do the work, I said. Specifically, the Patre. You, Jace. You personally must physically help rebuild their settlement. It shouldn't take long, a few weeks at most. They had so very little to begin with. I will stay on here, of my own free will, to make sure the work is done, and you will remove the guards at my door, so I will be a true guest, just as your letter so poorly tried to imply. Jace's hands curled into fists. His gaze was deadly.
Sign the letter.
Does this mean we have an agreement? His chin dipped in a stiff affirmation. Titus groaned. A hiss burned through Gunner's teeth. Mason shook his head.
Sign it,
Jace repeated and pushed the letter back in front of me. I looked at him, knowing I had chipped away a large piece of the Ballinger pride, but knowing something else about Jace too, or hoping I did. I saw it when he whispered stories to me late into the night, when he pressed a wish stock to my blistered foot. I saw it when he held Nash in his arms, then wiped away his tears. Thank you, I whispered. I dipped my pen back into the inkwell and signed with flourish. All is going well. In fact, after an unfortunate fire that destroyed some settlement structures, the Ballingers have generously agreed to rebuild them on a new site that will be even more productive. I know you've been busy with travel, but I hope this news will hasten your arrival here. Please bring Golden Thanis as a gift of goodwill. Our kind hosts deserve this honor. We look forward to seeing you soon. Your ever faithful servant, Cassie of Brightmist. Jace picked up the letter and examined it, looking for some sort of betrayal. Thanis? He asked. The thorny vine you saw embossed on my vest that the hunters took. It's on the Venden shield, too. It's a wild plant that's native to our land. We take great pride in it. It's our traditional gift we give to all visitors. Unless, of course, you think a weed is beneath you.
I remember seeing it on her vest. Titus said. A goodwill gift is fine, Gunnar interjected.
Jace nodded.
We'll be sure to have a nice gift for her, too.
With the letter signed, I was returned to my room. Drake and Tiago escorted me to my door, but then left, as per my agreement with Jace. When I went inside, I found a small bowl of fruit on the dressing table. Oranges. 3 perfect oranges. Had he already known I would sign the letter? Was this his thank you? I picked one up, my fingernail drawing a spray across its skin, and held it to my nose, breathing in its magic. Or maybe this was the thank you I never got for giving him the ring? No, I thought as I peeled it. This was just Jace remembering I loved oranges.
Chapter 22. Jace.
Even with both windows open, the air was hot, still, as if the world had stopped breathing. My back was damp against the sheets. It seemed impossible that only this morning when I woke I was lying on a bed of grass with Cassie nestled against my chest, a chain still connecting us. It was well after midnight, and I should have been passed out in my bed with exhaustion by now, but instead I tossed and turned and paced in one of the guest rooms. Olise had been afraid to tell me. I was finally back at Tor's watch and shut out of my own room. I could have easily had Cassie moved, but there were other battles ahead and this one wasn't worth fighting. And strangely, some part of me liked the idea of her being in my room. I wasn't sure why. This room was larger, more comfortable, meant to impress guests, and I knew by now she had probably explored everything in my room. What did she think? Had she gone through my books, searching for the stories I shared with her? Rummaged through my clothes? The forgotten clutter in the bottom of my wardrobe? There were 3 knives that I could remember. I suspected she already had one on her. I wasn't worried. Had she taken another bath? I saw the revulsion in her face when Titus threw the ears on the table. After she left, I grabbed him by the collar and threw him up against the wall. Don't ever do that again, I had told him. We may have dirty work to do, but everyone doesn't need to see it. Especially not her. I had seen her expression, the fear, when she thought I had harmed her friends. Killed them. The terror in her eyes had whittled through me like a dull knife. She had seen something in my face, maybe all of our faces. She knew death when she saw it. The harm I actually did do hadn't been hard for me, and I would do it again. Foley had come to tell me what had happened. When Mason, Gunner, Titus, and I walked into the warehouse, Lothar and Rancel already had them on their knees. Tiago and Drake hovered nearby.
We spotted their wagon in an alley, Rancel said. When we lifted the tarp, we saw the brewer's boy gagged and chained. The other chains were still empty. They hadn't gotten the rest of their cargo yet.
I stepped closer to the 3 men. 2 of them began crying, begging for mercy. The 3rd said nothing, but sweat beaded on his forehead. They were a more ragged crew than the ones who had taken Cassie and me. Their tattered clothing was ripe with stench, their knuckles creased with filth. But their story was the same. They'd been paid up front, but they didn't know by whom. The fellow who approached them with a fat purse wore a wide-brimmed hat pulled low, and they weren't even sure what color his hair was. "Which of you took the money?" I asked.
"He did,"
the two sniveling ones cried. I looked at the silent one, his sweat the only indication he knew the gravity of his situation. My hatred for him rose to a different level. It was personal. The brewer's boy was 14. "So you're in charge?" he nodded. "Have you done this before?"
"Not here. Other places. It's good money. But he said it had to be Hell's Mouth and..."
"You know whose town this is?" I asked. He swallowed, his expression suddenly crackling with eagerness.
"I'll give you a cut," he said. "We can make a deal. Half. You want half? Half for doing nothing?"
"You know what would have happened to the boy you grabbed?"
"A mine. He would have worked in a mine, that's all. Good hard work."
There was nothing good about dying in a mine. Nothing good about being shackled and hauled in the back of a wagon against your will. He couldn't conceive that the brewer's boy had a life, a future. He only saw him as an article of profit. I drew my knife.
"All. You can have it all," he pleaded. "The money's in my vest. Take it."
"All of it?" I stepped closer and knelt so we were eye to eye. "That's quite a deal you're offering, but I'm in a hurry, so here's a better one. I'll kill you quickly instead of letting my dogs tear you to pieces, which is what you deserve." I wasn't sure the words had even registered before I plunged my knife into his throat. Blood sprayed my shirt and face, and he was dead before I had pulled my knife free. I stood and my attention turned to the other two. They began wailing, trying to back away on their knees, but Mason and Titus stood behind them, preventing them from going anywhere.
"Want me to do those two?" Tiago asked.
I walked over as if studying them.
"Maybe not," I said. "Maybe they'd be more useful to us as messengers. Would you two rather be dead or deliver a message?"
"A message," they both agreed.
"Please, any message, we'll deliver it."
I motioned to Mason and Titus. They jerked their heads back by their hair, and in a swift second, an ear from each man was on the ground in front of them. Their screams bounced off the walls of the warehouse, but when I told them to shut up, they did. They had already witnessed what else could happen to them.
"Better.
Now here's the message. You go back to whatever hole you crawled out of, and you let everyone get a good long look at your ears, and you let them know who did it. The Ballingers. And you tell them that this is the kind of trouble they'll find in Hell's Mouth, and no amount of money that anyone offers them is worth it. The citizens of this city are off limits. And if I ever see either of you here again, even for a sip of water, we'll be cutting off something much more valuable to you than your ears. My word is good. You can count on it. Understand?" They both nodded.
"Good.
Our business is done then." I looked at Lothar and Ransel. "Get them bandaged up. I don't want them bleeding out before they deliver our message." It was on our way back to the main house that Gunnar said it was time for other messages to be sent too. The one my whole family was pushing for, and now I finally agreed. We had nothing to lose. Or so I thought. I still couldn't quite believe that to make good on my promise to my father, I had also agreed to rebuild a Venden settlement. If the gods had carried that news to his ears, he was probably beating on his tomb walls, demanding to be let out, demanding to name someone else as Patre. I rolled out of bed and went to the window. It was dark, the workyard below quiet. A dim, bluish light in the gate tower, the only sign that anyone was awake. And then I saw a shadow moving through the blackness. Or I thought I did. It was just as quickly gone. Maybe one of the dogs patrolling. Barking erupted, but quickly quieted again. Yes, only the dogs. I stepped away from the window, paced, and wondered if she was having as hard a time sleeping as I was. I remembered her face when I came to her chamber, at first soft, happy to see me.
but then it turned sharp. "What do you want, Jace?" I knew what I wanted. She did, too. My hand hovered as I debated whether I should knock. It was late, the middle of the night. If she was asleep, I would wake her. She's not asleep. I knew it was impossible, but I sensed it. I could feel her eyes open, scanning the walls, pulling the drapes shut, opening them again, watchful, unable to rest, needing a story, a riddle, something to ease her into a dream world. I rested my hand against the door, wanting to go in, knowing I shouldn't. "What is this, Cassie? What do you feel?" She couldn't answer me before when I had asked, or she wouldn't. Maybe it was best not to know. Her loyalties were clear. And so were mine. I pushed away from the door and walked back to my room. Candles glowed in red glass globes in the apse of the temple, and the heavy scent of amber hung in the air. I was the only one inside. The priests were asleep in the manse. They would find my offering in the morning. I took out my knife and nicked my thumb, squeezed it, letting the blood drip onto the plate of coins below me. "A coin for every child in the city. This is only between you and the gods, Jace. Not the priests, nor anyone else. This is your promise to protect them with your blood, just as Aaron gave with his blood to save the remnant. Gold pleases men, but blood serves the gods, because in the end, your life is all you have to give." The drops of blood trickled down the pile of coins, and they shifted, a bare clink echoing through the silent temple. My father's last desperate words were ones he had heard from his own father, words every patre heard. I had read them in the histories and transcribed them at an early age. The candlelight caught the glint of my gold ring. "I gave it to you when it mattered." She had stepped forward willingly and helped me, and instead of thanking her, I questioned why she hadn't given it to me sooner. Everything was more complicated now. Even something as simple as gratitude. Footsteps scuffled behind me. "You ready?" Mason had caught me on my way out and insisted on coming with me. "You lost your mind? Leaving without Straza?" And then he laughed. "Let's go." He walked down the center aisle toward me and whispered, "The town will be waking soon. We should go while it's still dark." We left, the streets silent, the roads dark. Halfway home, he asked about Cassie. "How did you two end up being..." He knew something had happened between us, but he stumbled with the rest of his question, as if he didn't know how to craft it, as if he was still not quite believing it himself. He had seen her slam me up against the wall, threaten to cut me. He hadn't taken it any better than I had. "It was different out there," I said. "She was different. So was I." "What about now? I don't know. I've never seen you like this. I know you're not asking for advice, but I'm offering it anyway. She might have been nice to curl up with out there, but back here, she's not someone you want to get tangled up with. She can't be trusted." I hated to hear him say it, but it was true. Cassie had secrets. She performed a skillful dance around everything we said. Last night I had seen genuine fear in her eyes when she thought I had hurt her friends. But then I saw how she played us too, the fear dissolving and being replaced by something skilled and calculating. It was the same look I had seen in her face when she had studied the driver. Like in her head, she was constructing something solid, stone by stone. Her shrewdness managed to get reparations we didn't owe out of the deal. Even with her letter, we had no guarantee the queen would come. But there was hope, and that was a short-term bandage we needed. I'd use it to my advantage for now. Soon we wouldn't need anyone tossing us crumbs of respect. Soon we'd have a greater share of trade on the continent, and it would be the kingdoms begging for a place at the table with the Ballingers. We reached Tor's watch.
But before Mason left to go back to his room and catch what little sleep was left of the dark morning hours, I said, "Tomorrow, when we go into town, pull Garvin from Tower Security and put him on her watch. She doesn't know him, and he melts into the background. Add Yersin as a decoy, too." Mason's brows rose. A decoy tail, especially for someone like Garvin who was good at what he did, was a grand admission of my doubts. I hoped Mason was wrong. I hoped I was wrong. Because I was still tangled up with her, and I didn't want to be cut loose.
Miandre is our storyteller. She tells us stories of before. It was a world of princesses and monsters, and castles and courage. She learned the stories from her friend's mother. Someday I will tell the stories too. But my stories will be about different monsters. The ones that visit us every day. Gina, 8. Chapter 23, Kazi.
Books were piled on the bed around me, ghosts peeking from their pages, a whisper here, there. Hold on no matter what you have to do. The Ballinger ghosts sounded as desperate as those I had known. Survive no matter who you have to kill. Maybe more desperate. I spent a good portion of the night reading the books from Jace's shelves. After thumbing through several, I realized that nearly all of them were handwritten, and most by Jace. Some of the first books on the top shelf were in a more childish scrawl. It seemed to be a part of his schooling, having to record the family history and stories in his own hand. Maybe that was another reason he knew it so well. Many of the histories were curious, not long stories, but hundreds, maybe thousands of short journal entries, some of them bare sentences, beginning with the first one from Grayson Ballinger. Write it down. Write down every word once you get there, before the truth is forgotten. It was one of the ways Pauline had taught Ren, Sinove, and me to read, copying some of the ancient histories of Gadrell. Though I hadn't begun to even fill a single book with words, much less shelves of them. This wall of books wasn't just a matter of a reading lesson. This was the Ballinger Code, a passion, never forgetting where they had come from, whereas some of us tried to do just the opposite. I found myself touching the words, imagining Jace as he wrote them, imagining him as a child like Nash, imagining him growing up in this large, close-knit, powerful family, imagining his concentration as he wrote every word. I startled awake to the sound of rapping at the door and found my hand still lying across the middle of an open book. It felt like I had barely dozed off. I had just thrown back the sheet when Verlin, Priya, and Jelaine burst through the door. Verlin carried a breakfast tray, Priya, a folded pile of clothes, and Jelaine plopped a pair of riding boots down on the floor, then made herself comfortable at the foot of my bed. They breezed in like they knew me, like I wasn't just a grudging guest, but someone else. Priya whisked open drapes, letting light flood in, and Verlin set the tray on the side table by the armchair and poured a warm drink into a cup from a small pewter pot. They all seemed in a cheerful mood, even the sullen Priya. She shook out a folded riding skirt, eyeing it for size. "This should fit. I'm taller, but this is one of my shorter skirts. It hits me just below my knees. It should be fine on you." I don't know what Jace was thinking when he sent for one of Jelaine's dresses. "He wasn't thinking," Jelaine said. "He was..." "Sorry to wake you," Verlin said, "but we're heading out soon." She handed me the cup she had poured and then a bowl of some sort of eggish pudding. Jelaine's gaze swept across the room. She had a broad grin pasted across her face. You kicked out Jace? She was clearly amused, seeing Jace only as her big brother and not as Patre. I didn't exactly. Let the girl eat, Verlin scolded. It's too early for questions. Where are we going? I asked. They explained that we were on our way to Hell's Mouth. Apparently, the whole family was making a show there today, so the Ballinger presence was strongly seen and felt. They didn't only want to erase doubts among the townsfolk, but also wanted to reinforce among the leagues that the passing of power hadn't weakened the family. I was to be part of that show. A premier soldier of the Venden Queen walking side by side with the family. And Jace, will I see him? Priya laughed, and she exchanged a glance with Jelaine. I think she still doesn't get it. Yes, Jelaine answered. You will definitely see Jace. We stepped out the front door of the main house, and Priya noted with a grumble that our horses still weren't here. I asked if there was time for a little tour before we left, and I was surprised when Verlin readily agreed. Why not? She answered. It looks like we have a few minutes until they bring the horses around. Maybe getting the lay of the land at Tor's watch wasn't going to be as hard as I thought. At least now that I was an insider. Getting around last night had been impossible. Eluding the guards wasn't hard, but unlike a very willing tiger, the dogs were trained not to take food from anyone, so the meat I had taken from the kitchen to cozy up to the beasts went to waste. And hissing, "Faster, Itza," did nothing to calm them. Apparently, they only liked hearing the order from Jace. But with a little patience, I was sure I'd find a way into their dark, snarling hearts. Even the most hardened lords and merchants had chinks in their cruel armor. Where are the dogs? I asked hesitantly as we walked down the front steps. You heard them last night? Priya asked. Only a little snarling. Probably just chasing a rabbit, Jelaine interjected. Verlin patted my shoulder. Don't worry. The night dogs are kenneled during the day. The only ones about now are the gate dogs, and they're likely resting in a nice shady spot. The days are getting so hot. She brushed back a thick lock of hair, and I was struck again with how young she seemed, and yet a widow already. This way, she said, pointing to a path that ran between the towering main house and another large building. As we walked past it, she told me that each of the houses had a name. This one here is Ray House. It was named for the first child of Grayson and Meandre. It holds the offices for the Ballinger businesses. Priya manages it. How many businesses do you have? Priya blew out a puff of air. Dozens. Farms, a lumber mill, the Ballinger Inn, but the main ones are managing the arena and Hell's Mouth. Dozens. What were the others she hadn't mentioned? It was those I was curious about, particularly the purpose of housing a cold-blooded killer. What was his business here? According to the Queen, the former watch captain at the Morrigese Citadel wasn't notably skilled at any one thing. He's an average swordsman, an average commander, but he's an above-average deceiver. His skill is in his patience. The betrayal of her family burned in the Queen as much as the betrayal of the kingdoms. She would never forgive nor forget it. Besides poisoning her father, the watch captain planned a massacre that killed her eldest brother, and he instigated another attack where her youngest brother lost his leg and her third brother was gravely wounded. He never fully recovered and died a year later. When the whole plot was uncovered, she found out that the captain's stake in all this, besides a fortune, was one of the many kingdoms the Komizar had planned to conquer. Gastineau was to be his. Captain Alarion never got his prize. All the outside world held for him now was a noose. Or perhaps he thought there was a second chance to regain what had slipped through his fingers. Is that what he hoped to gain here? His lost wealth and power? And why would the Ballingers be willing to give it to him? Did their ambitions match his? The records for all the businesses are kept here in Ray House. Priya is good with numbers, Verlin said with obvious pride. Priya shrugged. Numbers don't lie. They're far more reliable than people. Really? I questioned. Numbers can be manipulated. Priya shot me a long sideways glance. Not as much as people. A skeptical murmur rumbled from Jelaine. What Priya really likes is the solitude. Numbers don't talk back. She enjoys peace and quiet here, whereas I have to deal with a lot of griping mouths at the arena. And that, my sister, is your specialty, a griping mouth. Jelaine gave Priya a playful shove. The elder sister took it in stride. Their digs went no deeper than marketplace banter, where the cost was already assured. Their devotion was as certain as a firm price. Watch your head here, Verlin said, pushing back a branch. These need to be cut back, but I rather like the wildness of it. The path had narrowed, and we walked through a long, tunneled arbor that was thick with yellow climbing roses. The ground below it was littered with a rainfall of petals. It was a striking contrast to the foreboding spiked structures that towered on either side. One was meant to invite, the other to turn away. We emerged from the arbor onto the back side of the main house, where there was a sprawling garden with raked walkways, low hedges, and tall rows of shrubs. A large fountain bubbled at its center. Beyond the gardens were three more stone buildings with more sharp turrets. Homes, Verlin called them. That's Riverbend at the far end, Jelaine said. It houses our employees. Next to it, set back in the middle, is Grey Castle, where more family lives. My sister Dolise and her family, and a few cousins who are not overly social, live there. More family live down in Hell's Mouth. There are 78 of us Ballingers altogether, Priya said, and that's not counting third cousins. Third cousins like Paxton? I asked. An icy wall fell over Priya. Yes, Verlin answered. Like him. Of course, we are hoping for more little Ballingers soon, Jelaine quipped. Priya jabbed her elbow into her sister's side. Verlin jumped in quickly, as if trying to sweep past Jelaine's suggestion. And the one next to Grey Castle is Dark Cottage. Dark Cottage was not a cottage at all. It rose two stories above us with four spiraling turrets that went even higher. The cottage was made from glistening black granite. Who lives there? I asked. It's empty right now, Verlin answered, only filled with memories and stories. Her gaze was wistful. Sometimes guests stay there. And that's the tour, except for a few outbuildings, and the stables down that path over there. What about the vault? May I see it? Priya's brows arched. Down in the tunnel? You know about that? Jace told me. It's a bit dank and dusty, Verlin said doubtfully. Still, I'm curious after all the stories he told me. Jelaine and Priya exchanged a knowing smile, as if I had confessed something important. I'll have Jace show you the vault when we come back from town, Verlin said. The horses are probably ready for us by now, and the others will be waiting. With those words said, Jelaine and Priya left, walking back down the path eager to be on their way. But Verlin didn't move, her attention still fixed on Dark Cottage. I waited, unsure if I should go or stay. When they were out of earshot, she said, "Thank you for your letter to the Queen." I'm not sure thanks are in order. It was Gunner's letter. I only copied it. And you do know it came with a price? I didn't give the letter freely. The settlement, yes, I'm aware. I do know something about compromise. Sometimes we must give something up in order to gain something else that is more important to us. I see it as a win for both of us. The queen coming here, is that important to you? It was important to my husband, and that makes it important to me. Keeping promises is important. Soothing fears is important. Protecting Hell's Mouth is important. Yes, I thought. I understand about promises. Mine are important, too. As we walked back through the arbor, she paused, lightly touching my arm. I was wondering, by any chance, is Cassie short for Casimira? I stared at her, her simple question squeezing the air from my lungs. I tried to figure out how she knew. Did she suspect something about how I signed the letter? You've heard the name before? Yes, in Kandora. It's not an uncommon name up there among Fletchers, especially for first daughters. In their old tongue, it means sweet arrow, which is the... She continued to explain, but I already knew what the sweet arrow was. That rare arrow among a dozen quivers that flies truer and farther than the rest. The one in which a Fletcher's craft is elevated by something as intangible as the spirit within the wood. No, I answered. My name is just Cassie. But as we walked back to the front gate, my mind whirled with this new knowledge that even my own mother hadn't known. Had my father been a Fletcher from Kandora? Had he named me? Old wounds split open again. Every answer that should have been mine stolen like it was only a cheap trinket to be traded away at market. Thousands of years of history were revered by the Ballingers. My own brief history had been ripped from my grasp. There were 100 questions I would never be able to ask my mother. When we got back to the front gate, everyone was waiting for us. The army of Ballingers, Straza, and other hands, ready to head into Hell's Mouth. Everyone but Jace. All eyes fell on me. I might have been on the inside of the gate, but I was still a foreign object, a stone caught in a horse's shoe and dragged into their inner sanctum. Priya smirked. She had seen me scanning the group. Don't worry, he's coming, she said, as if to let me know nothing slipped by her. Come ride by me, Nash called.
Not just yet, Nash. I'm going to ride with Cassie first.
Heat raced between my ribs. I turned to see Jace approaching from another path, guiding two horses. One was coal black. Mine. I ran to him, checking his tack, all in place, but now dust-free and freshly oiled. His coat gleamed, and his mane was carefully groomed and braided. The others headed out through the gate, leaving Jace and me alone. I nuzzled my horse's neck and scratched his forelock. Mija gutra hazo, Mija, I whispered, and he blew out a robust snort of appreciative air, his expression of excitement, and a signal that he was ready for a gallop through open fields. He was high energy and meant for speed, a venerable breed of Vendon stock specifically bred for Ratan and not used to the long confines of a stable. His name is Mija? Jace asked. My focus remained on Mija's neck, and I nodded, unable to look at Jace, caught off guard by the sudden tightness in my throat. Stupid horse, I thought. Don't do this to me. But I couldn't hide that I was glad to see him.
The mane was Jelaine's idea. I hope you don't mind. She kind of fell in love with him.
It's a bit fancy for him, but I don't think he minds. He'll probably expect extra treats from me now, too. I looked up. Jace's eyes were trained on me.
Tiago found him at the livery when they were searching for you and the other rattan. He straightened, his shoulders stiff and uncomfortable, and he frowned.
We don't have the others, Cassie. We never did. I want you to know.
This wasn't about horses. He was talking about Ren and Sanove. Why tell me now?
Because of last night. I saw the look in your face. The fear. I don't want you to think of me that way. I would never harm them. You know that, don't you?
I thought about my reaction. I had been afraid. I had felt death in the room. It had rushed over my skin like a stampeding army of ghosts. And then I saw Jace. He had killed someone. I had known it. And dread had gripped me. My first thoughts had jumped to Ren and Sanove, and I realized that what I knew about Jace and what I knew about the Patre were two different things. The Patre ruled a different world than the one where Jace and I had roamed. I was still getting to know this other person. Why did you lie and say you had them?
They had disappeared, and we've had trouble in town. I have to consider all possibilities.
And if I believed that you had them in custody, you thought I might confess something. They became leverage. A crease formed between his brows.
Yes.
Jace, I had vanished into thin air, just like you. Maybe they feared they were next. Did it ever occur to you they might have disappeared because they were trying to keep their own necks safe?
It occurred to me. But where are they now? Everyone knows you're here and safe.
I don't know where they are.
Cassie, I don't know, Jace, I swear.
He studied me. Whatever he saw, it had to be truth, because I didn't know where they were now. Not exactly. I guessed they were on the move, probably from one crumbled ruin to another on the outskirts of town. And whenever I did make contact with them, they needed to remain out of the Ballinger's sights. I might be inside Tor's watch, but I needed them on the outside and not under scrutiny. He finally moved past the subject of missing rattan and said we needed to catch up with his family. He checked my cinch and handed the reins over to me. He looked at my boots as if still taking in the changes. Our long days of walking barefoot together were over.
This time yesterday.
I know, I said. We were still chained together.
A day can change everything, can't it?
Less than a day, I answered. A spare minute can send us careening down a new path and turn our lives upside down. He stepped closer.
Is that what your life is right now, Cassie?
He asked.
Upside down?
Utterly and completely, but I answered the way I should. Not at all. I'm a soldier who is now a guest in a very comfortable home, and we have struck up an agreement that will be advantageous to my kingdom, if you plan to keep your word. Distaste sparked in his eyes at the reminder of the reparations and resettling of the Vendans.
My word is good,
he grumbled, and he got up on his horse. I can't promise when or if she will come, you know. He nodded.
I know, but you've made a good faith effort. We can't ask for more than that.
Good faith. I slipped my foot into Misha's stirrup, settled into the saddle, then nudged him forward with a touch from my knee. The Straza, who had hung back waiting for us, followed behind. We were just past the gates when Jace asked how I had slept last night. Polite talk. Something I supposed people who lived in fine houses asked guests. I guessed that a polite response was required, even though I had barely slept at all. I couldn't reveal to Jace the reason why his comfortable room gave me no rest. It seemed that having his lovely cave of a bed wasn't enough after all.
it was still missing something. Him. He had become a bad habit. Too quickly, I'd become accustomed to the weight of his arm around me, the feel of his chest at my back, his whispers in my ear as I dozed off to sleep. Tell me another riddle, Cassie. If not for his books, I might not have dozed at all. Fine, I answered. And you?
I slept well. It was good to finally sleep in a soft bed instead of on hard ground.
It wasn't so hard. I remembered him commenting on the thick grass or the beds of leaves that rustled beneath us. He had liked it then. I was strangely disappointed by his answer. It was all so quickly left behind. Leaves, grass, us. And yet that was exactly what I had counted on. I had told myself over and over again that it would soon be behind us, that everything we said and did was all right because it was only temporary. It was our way to make the best of it. My own feelings had become a thorny riddle for which I had no answer. The road traversing back and forth down to Hell's Mouth was steep. I couldn't let Mija break into a gallop until we hit level ground, but when I finally gave him free lead, he was a black specter not tied to this earth. His gait so swift and steady, he became a dark wind flying down the road, and I was part of that wind. Jace worked to keep up, and the pounding, the noise, the strain in my thighs and calves as I lifted in the stirrups, the thump in my heart and bones made me feel alive. And the moment was all there was, and the answers to riddles were forgotten in the trail of dust behind us.
Chapter 24. Cassie.
As soon as we arrived in Hell's Mouth, I was whisked away by Verilyn, Priya, Jelaine, Nash, and Lydia, a whole troop of us heading toward the dressmaker.
Don't keep her long, Jace had called after us, an exasperated expression darkening his face. It was obvious this was not part of his plan, but apparently a Patre's mother and sisters could override even him in some matters. Verilyn said it would be best to get the visit out of the way first thing, so there would be time for the dressmaker to get some alterations done. She thought it necessary for me to have a few clothes of my own for my stay in Hell's Mouth, instead of just borrowed ones. I had to agree, especially in regard to underclothes. I promised to pay her back, but she waved me off, saying it was the least she could do after I had helped her son escape the labor hunters. Guilt riddled through me. She had no idea that I'd been forced to help him, and that my intent was to use him for my own purposes. My goals and loyalties hadn't changed. Ever since the Queen had asked me to find this fugitive, I had imagined the grand moment I would hand the elusive traitor over. You can make some things right. The moment had grown in my thoughts. It became a color that gleamed behind my eyes, a silver stitch in a wound that would close a gash that had been open for too long, or a golden stone in a tall wall that would finally erase my mistakes. I needed to believe that maybe even a worthless little crap cake like me could make a difference that mattered in this world. It became a deep need, and I worried. What if the watch captain had already vanished? What if he wasn't here at all? Sometimes people vanished, and no matter how badly you wanted to find them, they were never seen again. It was disquieting to be drawn into their family circle. I was certainly good enough at conversation. It was one of the tools of my trade. When I was forced to engage a merchant instead of just slipping away with my pilfered goods, I had to redirect their thoughts, make them so transfixed by something that they could perceive nothing else. Like the labor hunter who was so intent on the answer to the riddle I withheld, he forgot he even had keys at his side. But this was different. It felt far more intimate, their chatter, their laughter, the touching and nudging.
It didn't seem right that I should be in the middle of it. And yet, it intrigued me the way listening to a foreign language might, trying to understand the nuances behind their words. They held fabric up to my face and asked me what I thought. I didn't know. I left the decisions to them. The dressmaker quickly took measurements, and fabrics were chosen. The only other time I had been fitted for clothes was as a rattan soldier. We didn't have uniforms. We chose our own clothing, and I chose carefully. I missed my boots and the shirt I had been forced to shred in order to cross Bone Channel. But most of all, I missed my leather waistcoat the hunters had ripped from my possession while I was unconscious. It wasn't exactly like Jace's ring, but it was symbolic of something. The revered Thanis of Venda was gracefully embossed across the deep bronze leather. It was the most beautiful item of clothing I had ever owned. Growing up, I had only known layers of rags covering my back, and I was lucky to have those. Verlin spoke quietly with the dressmaker for a few moments while I entertained Lydia and Nash with the shell game using the dressmaker's thimbles. In a short time, as promised, I was delivered back to Jace and our tour of Hell's Mouth continued. He walked closely beside me, his shoulder occasionally brushing mine, his hand sometimes at the small of my back, directing me down one avenue or another. His close proximity was orchestrated, a subtle signal to all who watched and a confirmation that the rumors were true. Everyone could plainly see that it was, after all, the rattan soldier from Venda who had ended up being arrested by the charm of the Patre. I noticed Jace's ease when he spoke with the townspeople, how he knew the details of their lives and they knew his, how an old shopkeeper pinched his chin because he was one of the untamable Ballinger boys she had chased or chastised multiple times. "So you were trouble as a child, too?" I asked.
"Probably less trouble than you."
I didn't admit to him that he was probably right. But even with the pinching of his chin, the playful wagging of a finger, or the ruffling of hair, which he was far too old for but endured with a strained smile, there was an undeniable regard for his position, too. "Patre, good to see you."
"Patre, taste my powdered shrinka." "Patre, meet my new son."
And a baby would be shoved into Jace's arms. He was new to this part of his role, and he would awkwardly hold the squalling child, dutifully kiss its forehead, and hand it back. I learned it was a custom here for the Patre to pledge to protect and care for every child in the city, the same way the first Ballinger leader had. I had seen the merchants and citizens at Sanctum City nervously pander to the Komazar when he walked the narrow lanes of Venda. What I saw here wasn't fear, except when they spoke of recent troubles. After mentioning the recent spate of fires, a store clerk said he had heard rumors of caravan raids and wondered about the flow of supplies to the city. Jace assured him they were only false reports and nothing more. All was well and under control. I studied every avenue we passed out of habit. You never knew when one of them could become an escape route. I also scanned the shadows for Ren and Sinove.
"You might try to smile once in a while," Jace said, nodding back at someone we had just passed.
"Of course," I answered. "But I'm afraid that will cost you, Jace Ballinger. Everything comes with a price, you know. The Venden settlement could use a few more shorthorns, or maybe a root cellar. Do you like to dig, Patre?"
"I'm afraid that by the end of the day, you will be costing me far more than a root cellar."
I smiled, wide and deliberate. "You can count on it. Dig deep in your pockets. I have many more of these smiles to toss about." His hand slid around my waist, drawing me closer, and my pulse raced in an uneven beat when his lips brushed my ear.
"Be careful," he whispered. "I just might cost you something, too."
A breath skipped through my chest. "You already have. More than you know." The truth was, it was easy to smile, and it was more work not to. I drank in the smells, sights, and sounds of the city like I'd been offered a sweet nectar. If the brisk ride had made me feel alive and above this world, the streets here made me feel grounded. They were busy and familiar. Jace told me the story of the Tembris, the great trees that were like none I had ever seen. Legend said they sprouted from a shattered star that plummeted to the earth during the devastation. The stars carried magic from another world, which is why the trees reached back toward the heavens. It was a tall Ballinger story I could almost believe, and I loved that the giant trees created a shadowy maze that made the city itself blink with magic. Every corner came alive, ever-changing, exhilarating, and I memorized these details, too. Attention to detail was another sort of magic. It had helped me survive on the streets of Venda, and as I walked, I heard a familiar ghost tutoring me. "Watch, my Chiadra. My beloved. My everything." Chiadra, the crooning name she called me as often as she had Kazi. I had been her world. "Watch, and you will find the magic." It had been her lesson to me after I heard other children talking about the great gift of the Lady Venda. They said that her magical sight that helped the early Vendans was from a time past. They said that the gods had abandoned us, and now magic was dead. My mother shook her head furiously, denying it. "There is magic in everything. Only you must watch for it. It does not come from spells or potions or the sky, nor by special delivery of the gods. It is all around you." She had taken my shivering hands and clasped them between hers. "You must find the magic that warms your skin in winter, the magic that perceives what cannot be seen, the magic that curls in your gut with fierce power and will not let you give up, no matter how long or cold the days." She had taken me to the Jahendra and told me to watch carefully. "Hear the language that isn't spoken, Kazi. The breaths, the pauses, the fisted hands, the vacant stares, the twitches and tears. For everyone can hear spoken words, but only a few can hear the heart that beats behind them." Like wish stalks, my mother would not let me stop believing in magic, the hope it held. She was the one who taught me to discern, in a glimpse, the danger or opportunity that was not just in my path, but well beyond it. It almost became a game. "Where is the anger? Do you feel the air? Who is coming?" Every day she made me see in a deeper way, as if she knew one day she wouldn't be there for me, as if she knew something as precious as her love for me would not go unnoticed by the gods, and they would snatch it away like a jealous merchant. "Make a wish, Kazi, one for tomorrow, for the next day, and the next. One will always come true." Because if I could believe in tomorrow or the next day, maybe that would give the magic time to come true. Or better, maybe by then, I wouldn't need the magic at all.
"This way," Jace said, guiding me down another avenue.
I saw him eye some men at the far end of the street. His demeanor changed and his pace slowed. I asked who they were.
"Truco and Rybart, leaders of other leagues."
He said they controlled trade in smaller towns in distant regions and would love nothing more than to control Hell's Mouth. They all wanted a larger share of the Ballinger power, if not all of it. That made them suspect in the fires and appearance of labor hunters, but they brought business to the arena. It created a rocky sense of partnership, as long as everyone remembered their place.